So as we begin the talk this evening, I'd first like to really appreciate all of your efforts so far on this retreat. We're very much in the heart of the retreat now, in the middle of the retreat. And it's been very, very helpful and very moving to meet many of you. I've met about half of you in the smaller groups, and just to get a sense with all that's going on for all of you in all your different lives, all the different situations, and just really appreciating the care and the commitment that you bring to this practice. You state the obvious at this stage, but it's not always easy. But really is, I think, a very beautiful thing to be doing. And, you know, just by being here, we're supporting each other too. That can also be a really helpful thought at times when it's tough. You think, but I'm doing my bit for my fellow travellers here. And I wanted to begin by just thinking about a few of the different ways we could think about our practice, and really, in a sense, continuing the theme that Zohar explored yesterday. But the different ways we might understand what we're doing when we come on a retreat like this, or we're doing our practice. And actually, there are multiple ways. So I think this question of what are we doing and why are we doing it is one that we come back to, actually, again and again through our years, decades, perhaps, of practice. One starting point that came to my mind that's been important for me is that practice helps me to make a shift from a kind of taken-for-granted way of being in the world to one where there's more of a sense of wonder, more of a sense of beauty. And this is actually how I started. This memory was coming back to me here. But there in my dad's house, my dad's house is full of lots of different things, and it has lots of old books. And there was a book there called Zen Buddhism and Psychoanalysis, which was my first Dharma book that I ever looked at. And I didn't know anything about meditation or Buddhism or mindfulness or anything at the time. But I found myself being drawn to this book, which was by Eric Fromm and Suzuki. And it described a kind of practice where I think the practitioner was walking down the street and was just struck by the beauty of a flower. And they just kind of stopped. And then there was some kind of word in Japanese that can't quite be translated into English. And I wish I could remember it. But it's almost like the nearest we could get is wow. It's not quite it. But like you're sort of stopped in your tracks, really, by the kind of beauty of this flower. And then following the time I read this book, I was walking around North London and really looking at the trees. And I had just a couple of experiences of just really seeing the trees in a very new way. It's like, rather than just, there's a tree, I'm going to the shops or whatever, but really stopping to take it in and to drink in its beauty. And it's interesting because, that was really quite a transformative thing for me, sort of opened up this path in a way that I then didn't pursue formally for a little while after that. But there was some kind of possibility there. But I also remember after a while I thought of this as a technique. And when you do that, of course, it doesn't work. Sort of going back to the tree and coming, right, give me that good feeling I had the other day. There's already a bit of insight creeping in there, really, that when something becomes, rather than actually, what we might see as a disinterested sense of beauty of the tree, I started to want something back, give me that nice experience you gave me the other day. So that's an interesting shift, isn't it, from the world feeling taken for granted and routine and maybe a bit grey and dull, to that sense of wonder. There's a nursery near where I live in Nottingham that used to have a slogan, "Where wisdom begins with wonder." And I thought, what a great place to send young kids, that they have that as their ethos. Another way we can think of practice, by the way, these are definitely not mutually exclusive, I mean they're really all overlapping. Zohar was reminding me of this yesterday when she was talking about looking at the stars. And recently I've maybe, I don't know, some of you might have seen the Brian Cox program on the BBC about the universe. I found myself trying to get a sense of how big the universe is. Anyway, it's one of those things that it just begins to really open your mind, let's put it like that. And the sense that there are, this is that I'm now passing on the result of my research. They've estimated to be, I think, 100 billion stars just in our own galaxy, the Milky Way. And that's only one of billions of galaxies. So anyway, I don't know what that's doing to your mind. And try to look up how many stars there are in the universe, and I think the estimate is something between 10 to the power of 22, 10 to the power of 24. So if you're not particularly mathematical, that's one with 22 noughts after it, and 24. So it's a lot. And for me, I mean, almost, as you may tell from the way I'm speaking, I'm not necessarily coming from this with a particularly scientific point of view, but more just the feeling that a sort of unfathomable vastness. And it's quite something to be open to that. And when we look at the few that we can see, the relatively few we can see in the sky, it just looks wow. And I don't know about you, but I quite often forget that. I mean, that opens up a different perspective on what it means to be here, what it means to be alive, than I sometimes have. And I often see practice actually as a journey between remembering and forgetting and remembering and forgetting. So we can touch into these moments of a vast perspective where we feel connected with and part of this, you know, vast and beautiful universe. And then somebody says something to us that we don't like, and the whole sense of self and the world kind of collapses, and it's much more, they said that. And the longer I practice, the more I feel this is okay, by the way. I mean, I used to get more disappointed with that than I do these days. I just think that there is that movement, remembering and forgetting. Another vision of practice, which I'm only really personally beginning to explore. I mean, and Zohar and lots of my friends and colleagues at Gaia House, I think, have explored this much more than I have. But one I definitely respect and find very more extraordinary, significant, comes from Joanna Macy. You may know Joanna Macy, who's Dharma teacher who's for decades been writing about Dharma and ecology and the climate crisis, and how Dharma can help us to respond to that. And even in the little exploration I've done, I've come across this idea that I find very powerful, really, which is that she speaks about the stories that we live by. You know, have a look at the stories we live by. And she describes three stories in particular, and the first is called business as usual. So this might be where we're just part of a consumer society and we're quite happy to think, yeah, the more I buy, the happier I'll be. There's more and more economic growth, that's going to be what we need. Just kind of get on with it, everything's going to be okay. You know, the whole way we've been living is fine. And then the second story is a story much more of despair, really, where people begin to see through that business of as usual story and see the, how might we put it, the shadow side or the underbelly of what we have previously thought of as progress and development, and that, yeah, comes with huge and unacknowledged, often downsides. And then she talks about a third story, which is also, I think, really beautiful, because very often these days you can see people who make that shift from the first story to the second, and then they're really in these feelings of despair. And again, Joanna Macy, very beautiful vision of practice is not to deny despair. It's not like, oh, we need to skip that part out. It's something we can move through, something we can learn from, the wisdom of being with that process. But the third story also is that she suggests is actually about being part of a renewal, being part of finding something new, like a rebirth, we might say. A new way human beings can find to live on this planet. And of course that's not just like an individual thing, it's not for you or I to work that out, but just a feeling, and you can see it in small ways and big ways, of a kind of awakening to the urgency of that, the need for that, a new possibility. So this is a very much a story that could guide our practice, like how do we see through business as usual, how do we face painful truths without being lost in despair, and you know, what new fresh possibilities may emerge. There's a very open sense of what that is too. It's not like we need to know what the possibilities are. The sense of openness to what may emerge. There's so many of these, you know, this is a rich thing we're doing. Each one of these could be a talk in itself. But, you know, a whole other way of thinking around our practice, again, very related to the ones I've mentioned, is a shift in identity. That we can see this practice as about letting go of a small or fixed, or sometimes some teachers describe it as a kind of false sense of self. And then you get teachings that use language like, you know, then we find our true nature. And other people say, ah, let's be careful with this language of true nature, and that's a whole other debate. But definitely this can be part of our practice, that many of us, all of us perhaps, can have a rather limited or small sense of who we are or what we are. We can feel trapped in past stories, trapped in past patterns, as if particular things that arise for us define who we are. And so we can see practice is making this shift to a, sometimes we might see it as a larger sense of who we are, or a much more fluid sense of who we are. The freedom of not needing to be fixed and kind of bound down in our sense of identity. And for me, all of these, again, very related to a question that Jack Kornfield offers in his book, A Path with Heart. And again, a very related image of practice, which is about how do we learn to love? He says, when you think of your path, ask yourself the question, is this a path with heart? And he you know, offers a reflection if we were to think about looking back at our life, if we were towards the end of our life looking back, you know, what question really matters. And he's suggesting the question, you know, did I love well? Did I love well? And for me, that's very significant. I studied philosophy at university, and although that was very helpful in many ways, it can also trains a certain skepticism. You know, a certain kind of skeptical doubt is what we're trained in. And so for me, sometimes one thing I found very helpful that sort of cuts through if I feel I'm getting lost in intellectual questions or things that feel too difficult to work out or lead me to doubt is, do I want to live with love? Do I want to live with love? And the answer is a kind of heartfelt yes. You know, that's what I want to do. And then even the skeptical philosopher who might say, well, how do you know love is there? Doesn't really have any bite to me. It's like, that's my starting point. That's my axiom. You know, an awful lot of stuff we can be confused about in life, but you can think, ah, maybe that's something I can trust. And all of these different visions of the path, which, as I said, are very interconnected and related, all of them are significant, we can think about them as things that unfold over time. And in my earlier years of practice, I think that was a kind of dominant view that I had. So in other words, I would come on retreat and I would sit, and the idea would be that, sort of little by little over the months and years, I would be treading this path, so very much conceiving the path as one where I would improve over time, if that makes sense. You know, I'm doing this now, I'm this kind of sort of confused person, and if I just do this enough, maybe, just maybe, in 5-10 years' time, the light will come on and all will be clear. And there's a relative truth in that, by the way. I mean, I think there is a truth that our path matures over time. We can find shifts happening, very significant. But at the same time, I also, these days, very much emphasize the idea that we walk these paths each moment. And so each moment is an opportunity to cultivate love. Each moment is an opportunity to cultivate clear seeing. Each moment is an opportunity to let go of limiting or smaller senses of who we are. And it's a bit like that description I gave you earlier of remembering and forgetting, remembering and forgetting, remembering and forgetting. And so the meaning of our path is not some future event, makes sense. It's not like we're doing this now in order for such and such to happen in the future. But you can also really get that sense it's here and now. Here and now we can find wisdom, love, and care. It's helpful as we reflect on the path too, to just notice if other agendas sneak in. And they tend to do that for us because psychological patterns that are very ingrained tend to get hold of the language of meditation or spirituality and can then sort of use them for their own ends. So that may sound a little bit cryptic, but to explain what I mean, I can draw on a teaching from Tara Brach. And she describes that for many, many years she practiced in an ashram, and she practiced really very intensely. And I think she said something like that they had to get up at 3 a.m, but she was so keen, she got up at 2, you know. So this is a sort of kind of level of practice. And, you know, doing lots of yoga, asana, and meditation. But at a certain point in her practice, there was this shift in her understanding where she realized that much of this was being driven by what she calls the trance of unworthiness. Trance of unworthiness. that somehow underneath all of that dedicated practice was a belief that she wasn't okay as she was, and she needed to be different and better and some kind of improved version of herself in order to feel lovable, in order to be lovable. And so she describes this as a very significant shift in her practice, where the trance of unworthiness is simply guiding the practice. You know, it's shaping what we do. So almost without knowing it, we're sitting here thinking, there's something wrong with me, and this is going to fix it. So there's a shift from that to actually shining the practice on that very view. So rather than there's something wrong with me and I need to do all this to get it right, but we can begin to see through the view that there's anything wrong with us. Makes sense. It's a really lovely shift. But again, as I mentioned, these patterns go really quite deep. We all have different patterns. If you have a more perfectionist pattern in your life, then that can very easily get transferred to this. You know, from being the perfect student to the perfect person at work to the perfect partner, now we have to be the perfect meditator and get it all right. So all these things are really, you know, to reflect on, and then they can be used as kind of skillful means, really. So a skillful means of seeing through this trance of unworthiness is really sensing, ah, it's already here and now. Let's see how that lands with you as I say that. It's already here and now. And again, we don't need to be philosophical and like, what is the it and where is it? But it can have a different feel of our practice, you know, not anxiously struggling to become somebody else. But sense of recognizing that which is already here and is always here. So I also wanted to speak a little bit about how our practice can really help us very much on a day-to-day level, you know, on the level of relationships, on the level of work and family. And as I said, all of these things are so linked. I mean, the practice, yes, is about sensing the vastness of the universe, and it's also about how do we get on with our friends and family, and how do we make our way in the world. I'm a great lover of the ox herding pictures in Zen. I don't know if you know these, but their description of the path, and some of the ones in the middle and towards the end are things like, you may say, this is a paraphrase, it's not exactly like this, but a little bit like going to the top of the mountain, you know, and visions of vast freedom and emptiness and profound wisdom. And the thing in this pictures, though, is that that's not the last picture. The last picture is called Return to the Marketplace. Yeah. And I always love that. And I don't know if you have that sense of your practice, that it's not really simply about, yeah, going to the top of the mountain and having whatever understandings and realizations we have. It's also about then living that, embodying that. What difference does that make as we make our way in the world? So I wanted to do this by sharing a story that I came across in a psychology textbook. It's quite a simple story, but I actually found it very moving. And the story is that there's a woman who wants to meet her friend for lunch. So she arranges this lunch date. And the friend doesn't turn up. The friend forgets and doesn't come. So far, so simple. But the person who was there feels so angry about this and becomes so fixed in her view of her friend and the situation that in the end, this friendship falls apart. So the other person does everything you would expect such a person to do in that situation. I'm really sorry, I did want to see you. I've just had so much on at work, it completely slipped my mind. I really value our time together. Can we make another time? And this person was, no, you've disrespected me. This, you know, nobody treats me like that. I don't want anything to do with you. And then the person leaves it a week or so and says, it's been a while, but I really just wanted to say, I do understand that was very difficult for you. And I would feel the same if somebody didn't turn up, but you know, my door's always open. And the person's, no, I don't want anything to do with you. And it, you know, in a way it's a very simple story, but I found it actually quite a moving, tragic story, you could say, poignant. And, you know, at times, I don't know about you, but I can recognize myself in that person. I may not behave in exactly that way, but I can recognize that sense of what's happening when I get into a more fixed position or more intransigent position and seem to have lost a sense of wider spaciousness. And if you think about the significance of this for our lives, it's huge. Because if every time something like this happens, a friendship stops, you know, it's actually very difficult, isn't it, to maintain friendships. And maintaining friendships is so supportive for our well-being. It's a big issue, yeah, to continue to react in that way. So I wanted to, yeah, just reflect a little bit on a teaching that can make some sense of what happens in those kind of situations. So this is the teaching of the 12 links of dependent origination. And you can do whole courses and whole retreats on this. So I'm going to be mentioning these in a more brief way than you might hear, but it's a very skillful teaching talking about the way that suffering arises. And we can use the situation I've just described to illustrate some of it. So it begins with what's called ignorance, yeah, or not seeing, we're not aware. So we could see this in all kinds of ways, when we're just acting automatically, when we're not really mindful and present around what's happening, when we are confused around what's happening in a moment, when we're taking things to be more solid than they really are. All of these things could be part of this notion of ignorance. We're not seeing clearly, we're unaware. And what happens then, is this word sankharas that can be translated in many ways, but today I'm thinking of it as kind of habit patterns, habitual formations in the mind, habit patterns. So when you start putting these two together, when we're not seeing clearly, when this ignorance is present, habit patterns, habitual ways of seeing, feeling, behaving, are operating. Yeah. Does that make sense? It's quite simple so far. Yeah? When we're unaware, these habitual patterns are operating. And these then shape a couple of factors that together essentially mean our mind and body in the moment. So what we're perceiving, the way we're perceiving, what we're noticing, what we're not noticing. You know. So if you start to think of this person in this example, so she's there and the friend hasn't turned up, and maybe she's, you know, there's not so much awareness or presence or sense of mindfulness and investigation there, and the old pattern kicks in. So what might that old pattern be for that person? Like, you know, people always disrespect me, or things don't work out for me, people let me down, you know, some people can have that belief quite strongly there, latently. And so in this situation it comes up, this habitual pattern there. or even more in a more generalized sense, as Zohar was saying, there can be the pattern to notice what's wrong. It's often called the negativity bias, the kind of habitual pattern that's operating in the moment. So rather than thinking, oh, this is a rather nice restaurant, or I've got that book in my bag that I could pull out and read, or I could have a joke to the waiter, or all kinds of other possibilities, the habitual pattern is just focusing on what's wrong. My friend isn't here. This is disrespectful. Yeah. So this is shaping the mind and body. Yeah, so the mind and body, then, we're very focused on perceiving what's not okay. Sense of lack feels quite strong. And from there, the sense organs are operating in accordance with that. What we see here, taste, touch and smell, we make contact with the world, that then has what's called a feeling tone. Many of you may know this word, vedana. Yeah, this means pleasant or unpleasant or neither. So in this case, the absence of the friend is perceived as very unpleasant. Yeah. Maybe alongside that, there are various changes in the body. There's a tightening in the jaw, and the hand is tightened a little bit. Also experienced as unpleasant, a tension around that. And this teaching then describes how vedana, which I'm reflecting on unpleasant but can also be pleasant, then kind of grows when we're not aware. That's how I see these next stages. So craving becomes, vedana becomes craving, becomes clinging. So you can see that what starts off, this is unpleasant, becomes, I don't like it. I can't stand it. I want to get rid of it. It shouldn't be there. Can you see? There's a movement here of something growing. It's a little bit like if you could see vedana as just like the first little shoot of a weed coming out of the ground. And then if we don't see that, it gets bigger and grows into this sense, I don't like it. Or in the case of pleasant vedana, I do like it. I want it. I want to hold on to it. And this grows then into clinging, which also has the meaning of adding fuel to the fire. Adding fuel to the fire. And from there, it leads to what's called becoming and birth. And the Thai teacher, Ajahn Buddhadasa, wrote a wonderful book. And his central point was that the word jati in Pali, birth, in the Buddha's teaching means something psychological. It means a sense of identification rather than physical birth, you know, from a womb. So when the Buddha, according to Buddhadasa, when the Buddha is speaking about the ending of rebirth, it's not talking about past and future lives, but this process of identification that happens. So how does that happen to this person in the restaurant? She becomes, the becoming and the birth, becomes a person who's angry, who's frustrated, who's feels a strong sense of lack, who's feeling that the world is untrustworthy, who feels that the friend has really let her down. So that sense of self has arisen in the moment. Yeah? And this teaching is tracing how when we notice it, we can actually see that it's built. Yeah? It's a process that we can begin to see that actually starts, or where does it start? It's a good question because it goes around. But one of the places we can feel it starting was just this very basic sense of something being pleasant or unpleasant. I want to give you another example, actually, one that I've often used. But imagine that you've booked into a hotel and you've been really looking forward to going to the hotel. And obviously with the lockdown and everything happened, maybe you haven't been to one for a while. And you're really looking forward to it. You've looked on the website, you've looked at the photos and the reviews, and you think, this is going to be great, it's just what I need. And you get to your hotel and you go into the room and you notice the furniture and you look a little closer and you see it's chipped, scratched. And you look a little further and the curtains are a bit old and actually they don't smell very nice. Yeah. So what happens then? Yeah. See, so far, really, I'm just describing this level of Vedana. Yeah, there's an unpleasant Vedana associated with the smell of the curtains, the sight of the furniture. And depending on what happens, we may simply leave it as that, or we may not. Yeah? So if this process kicks in again, it's not just, this is unpleasant. It's like, this is unpleasant. I don't like it. I can't stand it. It shouldn't be like this. This is unbearable. This is the kind of movement. And in that moment, if all of this kicks in, we become born, psychologically speaking, again as a person who's frustrated, whose holiday is ruined, who's feeling that the world is against them. Now, it's so freeing to see how that whole story and that whole construction can be traced back to this basic experience of noticing the scratched furniture. Yeah. We can start to notice this process and start to free ourselves from this process. It's fascinating, isn't it, to see. Fascinating, he says, but also sometimes very painful. To see in these moments when our states of mind are very heavily triggered like this, that it colours our whole sense of the self, the world, the future, other people. This is well known in cognitive psychology, and the cognitive psychologist Beck spoke about this in terms of depression. When people are depressed, that they have more negative views of themselves, negative views of the world, of other people, the future. And all of this comes from a particular state of mind that can get built and constructed. You know, what's the state of mind of that person who's so frustrated in the hotel? Yeah. It could even be a sense that the world is full of people you can't trust. You can't trust these hotel managers. They're always trying to con us, really, that they, you know, they put these nice brochures up and then they give us this terrible place. And if you notice it when we're in that place, you know, I notice it when I'm in this place, you know, that our thoughts become much more simplistic, much more black and white, much more global. You notice in those times when it's all blown up, you have thoughts like you can't trust anybody, thoughts like this is a nightmare, why does this keep happening to me? You don't have thoughts like, do you? This is somewhat disappointing given my expectations, but actually quite a lot of my life is okay. And we're not thinking like that. It's like it's a nightmare. It's a nightmare. So, interestingly, as well as that 12 links of dependent origination in another discourse, the Buddha really talks about the same process, but from a slightly different angle, and this is in the Honeyball Sutta, where he talks about the link between contact, feeling, perception, thinking, and the proliferation of thought. Now, in my understanding, this is really happening at the same time as the process I've just been talking about of craving, clinging, becoming. It's if you like, another way of talking about the same thing, or another aspect of the same thing. It's talking more about the cognitive aspect of it. Yeah. So, again, we'll stay with the hotel room for the moment. There's a contact, which basically means you see or smell something. Feeling tone arises, this is unpleasant. And then the perception, in this case, might be a thought like, this is ugly, or this is disgusting, or this is terrible. Now, But in that process of perceiving, something becomes a little more fixed. Yeah, a little more fixed. So the sense of life being fluid, you know, there's just this sense of, ah, I can fix this down, I can label this. This is a more kind of solid thing. And then we start to think about it, you know. So again, in that example, why? Yeah, I've given you some of the thoughts that might come, but it would be like, oh, why is it like this again? This wasn't how it was on the website. I think they might be cheating us. I don't think this is fair. This isn't really going to ruin my holiday. And thinking then can proliferate. In Pali, the word is papancha, which means proliferation of thought, which basically means it snowballs. You know this feeling when our thoughts are snowballing? And it may sound, I mean, it's funny this actually, because to me it does sound a bit funny when I say this, but I really want to acknowledge it's not at all funny when we're in it. But it is really possible for that unpleasant sight of the scratch furniture. If you think about how that works, I don't like this, I can't stand it, they're cheating me, why does this always happen to me? And then you're not far off, why does nothing ever go right for me? Which is the kind of thought you have when that's really strong. That's a very painful, yeah, very painful thought. But it's also, in a strange sense, quite, when we begin to see, gosh, you can wake up from that thought. All of that from, there can be that moment, how did I get there? Oh, it was this scratched thing. So there can be these moments where it's like we wake up from a bad dream. We wake up from a bad dream. I was recommending, wasn't I, sometimes in the meditations, opening the eyes from time to time. It can have that effect. If you notice there's one of these real storms going on and the eyes are closed, and it all feels so real and heavy and solid. You know, as I mentioned, when I've done that sometimes, it's almost a surprise, I'm at Gaia House. Oh, okay, I'm here. You know, because there's some compelling drama in my mind. Yeah. So, alongside many of those things I mentioned, for me this is a very inspiring sense of how practice can really support us in this path of wisdom and love that we've been describing is really supported by our meditation practice, because we can begin to see these patterns more and more. We can begin to understand these processes. We can see them in our own experience, and that opens up the possibility of finding some freedom from them, within them. It'll be different at different times. One article on mindfulness, an academic article I very much appreciate, describes how mindfulness works by, what does it say, increasing cognitive, behavioral and emotional flexibility. Which to me actually really, you know, it is very helpful. In other words, we can think about things more flexibly. We can begin to see that there are different perspectives we can have. So that was so tragic about the person who's, you remember the person whose friend didn't turn up for lunch? You know, locked in one way of seeing it. The cognitive flexibility, there are other ways of seeing this. You know, this the other way of seeing that might be, yeah, this was disappointing, it was hard, I did feel a bit embarrassed, but I really value her, I'd like to see her again. So with that cognitive flexibility becomes emotional flexibility, rather than being stuck in the feelings of rage and despair that just burn away around that. Actually, the emotions can move through more. So again, in my sense of that, it doesn't mean that if a friend turns up to lunch, you don't feel a thing. I don't think that's the aim of the practice. You know? But actually, that things just feel more fluid, so they can move. Can move through. And then the behavioral flexibility. You're more likely to be able to say to your friend, I was disappointed, I really wanted to see you, it was hard that you didn't turn up. But yeah, let's meet up again. Do you see that? Again, the behavioral flexibility is not saying everything's fine, there was nothing to worry about. You can still say you're upset. Ordinary human thing to do, but it's just a bit more transparent. And there's some freedom there. And then in the hotel room you can be more free too. You can either think, fine, things are a bit scratched, but I'll get on with my holiday. You could even have the choice to go and ask if there was a different room. Yeah, it doesn't have to be that the choice is always, I'll just stay with it, it's only scratch furniture. But you can see we're moving from a place of being governed by, thrown around by automatic, habitual patterns that perpetuate and keep us stuck. And we're finding flexibility, yeah, of thought, of perspective. Emotional life feels more fluid and more choice about how we can live and what we really care about. Good. So, yeah, I'm coming towards the end, but yeah, just trusting that all of these different ways of thinking about our practice really can live together. And they're all important for me, by the way. I don't mean to divide us into camps. Are we in the vastness of the universe camp? Or how do we deal with the situation when a friend doesn't turn up for lunch camp? Or, you know, actually, they're all part of it. They're all part of this process of waking up, you know, different levels of that. Personal, interpersonal, global. Yeah, and as I speak to you now, what's alive for me is just the beauty of that, that freedom to be, yeah, no longer just governed and thrown around by habit. But yeah, it's like a space opens up. The space opens up. So, you know, often in the Buddhist tradition we talk about the end of this, the end of greed, hatred and delusion, the end of suffering. But there really is also a kind of sense of what's left, or what's instead. And, you know, that's, in many ways we could talk about that, but like the Brahma-viharas, what's instead is loving kindness and compassion and joy and equanimity. Or as Zohar was saying the other day, what's left is responsiveness. Again, perhaps these are different ways of talking about the same thing. A free and responsive and caring and engaged heart. Yeah. So we're not practicing to stay on top of our mountain, but to come back into the marketplace and, yeah, be there with a free heart. So, yeah, let's take a minute or two just to sit quietly. Let the words of the talk settle. So as we take a couple of minutes to be still again, there's no need to remember all of the details of the talk, but perhaps just staying, noticing anything that feels meaningful for you, significant. Taking time just to notice, to pause, and to be still.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.